The Meeting with President Roosevelt. A world broadcast from London, August the 24th, 1941.
I thought you would like me to tell you something about the voyage which I made across the ocean to meet our great friend, the President of the United States. Exactly where we met is a secret. But I don't think I shall be indiscreet if I go so far as to say that it was somewhere in the Atlantic, in a spacious landlocked bay which reminded me of the west coast of Scotland, powerful American warships protected by strong flotillas and far-ranging aircraft awaited our arrival and, as it were, stretched out a hand to help us in. Our party arrived in the newest, or almost the newest, British battleship, the Prince of Wales, with a modest escort of British and Canadian destroyers. And there for 3 days I spent my time in company, and I think I may say in comradeship, with Mr. Roosevelt, while all the time the chiefs of the staff and naval and military commanders, both of the British Empire and of the United States, sat together in continual council. President Roosevelt is the thrice chosen head of the most powerful state and community in the world. I am the servant of King and Parliament, at present charged with the principal direction of our affairs in these fateful times. And it is my duty also to make sure, as I have made sure, that anything I say or do in the exercise of my office is approved and sustained by the whole British Commonwealth of Nations. Therefore, this meeting was bound to be important, because of the enormous forces at present only partially mobilized but steadily mobilizing, which are at the disposal of these two major groupings of the human family, the British Empire and the United States, who, fortunately for the progress of mankind, same language.
Churchill then went on.
We had the idea, when we met there, the President and I, that without attempting to draw final and formal peace aims, or war aims, it was necessary to give all peoples, and especially the oppressed and conquered peoples, a simple, rough and ready wartime statement of the goal towards which the British Commonwealth and the United States mean to make their way, and thus make a way for others to march with them upon a road which will certainly be painful and may be long. There are, however, two distinct and marked differences in this joint declaration from the attitude adopted by the Allies during the latter part of the last war, and no one should overlook it. The United States and Great Britain do not now assume that there will never be any more war again. On the contrary, we intend to take ample precautions to prevent its renewal in any period we can foresee by effectively disarming the guilty nations while remaining suitably protected ourselves. The second difference is this, that instead of trying to ruin German trade by all kinds of additional trade barriers and hindrances, as was the mood of 1917, we have definitely adopted the view that it is not in the interests of the world and of our two countries that any large nation should be unprosperous or shut out from the means of making a decent living for itself and its people by its industry and enterprise. These are far-reaching changes of principle upon which all countries should ponder. Above all, it was necessary to give hope and the assurance of final victory to those many scores of millions of men and women who are battling for life and freedom, or who are already bent down under the Nazi yoke. Hitler and his confederates have for some time past been adjuring, bullying, and beseeching the populations whom they have wronged and injured to bow to their fate, to resign themselves to their servitude, and for the sake of some mitigation and indulgences, to collaborate, that is the word, in what is called the new order in Europe. What is this new order which they seek to fasten first upon Europe, and if possible, for their ambitions are boundless upon all the continents of the globe? It is the rule of the herring folk, the master race, who are to put an end to democracy, to parliament, to the fundamental freedoms and decency of ordinary men and women, to the historic rights of nations, and give them in exchange the iron rule of Prussia, the universal goose step, and a strict, efficient discipline enforced upon the working classes by the political police, with the German concentration camps and firing parties, now so busy in a dozen lands, always handy in the background. There is the new order. Napoleon in his glory and his genius spread his empire far and wide. There was a time when only the snows of Russia and the white cliffs of Dover, with their guardian fleets, stood between him and the dominion of the world. Napoleon's armies had a theme. They carried with them the surges of the French Revolution. Liberty, equality, and fraternity, that was the cry. There was a sweeping away of outworn medieval systems and aristocratic privilege. There was the land for the people, a new code of law. Nevertheless, Napoleon's empire vanished like a dream. But Hitler has no theme, not but mania, appetite, and exploitation. He has, however, weapons and machinery for grinding down and for holding down conquered countries, which are the product, the sadly perverted product, of modern science. The question has been asked, how near is the United States to war? There is certainly one man who knows the answer to that question. If Hitler has not yet declared war upon the United States, it is surely not out of his love for American institutions. It is certainly not because he could not find a pretext. He has murdered half a dozen countries for far less. Fear of immediately redoubling the tremendous energies now being employed against him is no doubt a restraining influence. But the real reason is, I am sure, to be found in the method to which he has so faithfully adhered and by which he has gained so much. What is that method? It is a very simple method. One by one. That is his plan. That is his guiding rule. That is the trick by which he has enslaved so large a portion of the world. 3.5 years ago, I appealed to my fellow countrymen to take the lead in weaving together a strong defensive union within the principles of the League of Nations, a union of all the countries who felt themselves in ever-growing danger. But none would listen. All stood idle while Germany rearmed. Czechoslovakia was subjugated. A French government deserted their faithful ally and broke a plighted word in that ally's hour of need. Russia was cajoled and deceived into a kind of neutrality or partnership while the French army was being annihilated. The Low Countries and the Scandinavian countries, acting with France and Great Britain in good time, even after the war had begun, might have altered its course, and would have had, at any rate, a fighting chance. The Balkan states had only to stand together to save themselves from the ruin by which they are now engulfed. but one by one they were undermined and overwhelmed. Never was the career of crime made more smooth. Now,
Winston Churchill then spoke as follows.
We had a church parade on the Sunday in our Atlantic Bay. The president came onto the quarterdeck of the Prince of Wales, where there were mingled together many hundreds of American and British sailors and marines. The sun shone bright and warm, while we all sang the old hymns, which are our common inheritance, and which we learned as children in our homes. We sang the hymn founded on the psalm which John Hampden's soldiers sang when they bore his body to the grave, and in which the brief, precarious span of human life is contrasted with the immutability of him to whom a thousand ages are but as yesterday and as a watch that is passed in the night. We sang the sailor's hymn for those in peril, and there are very many in peril on the sea. We sang Onward, Christian Soldiers. And indeed, I felt that this was no vain presumption, but that we had the right to feel that we were serving a cause for the sake of which a trumpet has sounded from on high. And so we came back across the ocean waves, uplifted in spirit, fortified in resolve. Some American destroyers, which were carrying mails to the United States Marines in Iceland, happened to be going the same way too, so we made a goodly company at sea together. And when we were right out in mid-passage one afternoon, a noble sight broke on the view. We overtook one of the convoys which carry the munitions and supplies of the New World to sustain the champions of freedom in the old. The whole horizon, whole broad horizon, seemed filled with ships. 70 or 80 ships of all kinds and sizes, arrayed in 14 lines, each of which could have been drawn with a ruler. Hardly a wisp of smoke, not a straggler, but all bristling with cannon and other precautions, on which I will not dwell, and all surrounded by their British escorting vessels, while overhead the far-ranging Catalina airboats soared, vigilant, protecting eagles in the sky. And then I felt that hard and terrible and long drawn out as this struggle may be, we shall not be denied the strength to do our duty to the end.